So on Capitol Hill, is there a $700 billion deal to save Wall Street?
We believe that we're prepared to act expeditiously on a package to our colleagues.
We hadn't gotten an agreement.
Taxpayers are getting help in this.
There's a lot of different opinions.
As well as going forward with the program that we help will be a positive signal to the market.
That agreement is obviously no agreement.
Reports of shouting matches, a Treasury secretary down on bended knee, and a Republican revolt against their president. That's politics in America. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Friday, September 26th. Sounds like business as usual, Adora. Good morning.
Yeah, to the extreme. Good morning, John.
So on Capitol Hill, there's an unfolding drama, but still no deal. We're going to talk about the details. Meanwhile, the latest casualty, Washington Mutual has become the largest bank failure in U.S. history. J.P. Morgan swallowed it up. Also, a report on terror in Pakistan. What is the state of that relationship? Those stories coming up. But first, we have these headlines. As we mentioned, it's the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. Federal regulators have taken over Washington Mutual's assets and sold them to J.P. Morgan Chase for $2 billion. The change means little for customers, but it is bad news. It's the second time in 6 months that J.P. Morgan Chase has taken over a financial institution. They've already swallowed Bear Stearns, you may remember. No deal on the White House's proposed $700 billion bailout plan. Things are getting tense in Washington. Barney Frank, the Democratic chair of the House Financial Services Committee, though, paints a rosy picture.
We are responding, I think, to the central thrust of that request, but adding collectively a number of things that will make people legitimately feel better.
GOP lawmakers don't feel better. They're refusing to embrace the proposal. Instead of the government buying up bad debt, they want tax breaks and a new government-backed insurance program. Negotiations resume today.
The financial standoff has tonight's first presidential debate on hold. Barack Obama says he plans to show up at the University of Mississippi today, but John McCain would not commit, saying the massive financial bailout plan comes first. The federal corruption trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens is underway. His attorney says Stevens was just clueless about the cost and scope of a pricey makeover of his Alaskan cabin. Prosecutors say he knew better and lied on Senate financial disclosure forms.
Call it cabin fever. In Cologne, Germany, state police say a special commando unit stormed a KLM flight early today and arrested two terrorist suspects. News reports say the men left a note saying they wanted to die for a jihad. Pakistan's new president, Asif Ali Zardari, told the UN General Assembly his country can't allow its territory to be violated, even by its friends. This after Pakistan's soldiers fired at a U.S. reconnaissance helicopter today along the Pakistan-Afghan border. Markets are waiting and watching.
And we're talking all morning about the bailout plan and the collapse of Washington Mutual. How is it going to affect you? What questions do you have about what's going on?
This financial crisis has actually come to your neighborhood in the form of Washington Mutual's ATMs. If you go there this morning, they're J.P. Morgan Chase ATMs. But what is your story of how this is affecting you? We've been taking stories from you really for the last several weeks. How is this going to affect your life? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. What's the name of that show? Deal or No Deal?
We believe that we're prepared to act expeditiously on a package to our colleagues that will allow us to send a message to the markets that the Congress heard the message.
We hadn't gotten an agreement. There's still a lot of different opinions. Mine is it's flawed from the beginning.
I'm going with no deal. That's Senator Richard Shelby and Senator Chris Dodd speaking at odds over whether there is a deal today. Still no ink on any paper and no actual deal on the $700 billion bailout that was on discussions on Capitol Hill all day yesterday, went to the White House, and we still don't know what's going on. In 1906, J.P. Morgan actually literally bailed out the U.S. economy. If you woke up this morning as a Washington Mutual customer, J.P. Morgan did it again. You're now banking with J.P. Morgan Chase. That bank bought Washington Mutual in the largest bank failure in U.S. history. That happened overnight. We'll have more on the government-imposed sale of WAMU. But first, 6 days of bare-knuckle negotiations to bail out Wall Street this morning, and we don't have a deal, and we don't know what the details even are. What we do know is that there's lots of drama behind the scenes, reports of begging on the part of the Treasury Secretary, verbal brawls. Joining us now is New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn. David, first of all, the drama, please.
There's a lot of drama. It was a pretty wild day in Washington, and I think what you're seeing is what Washington looks like when everybody is just about to do something that nobody wants to do and nobody wants to own.
And in the middle of an election year, by the way.
And that's right. So everybody has to look like they're really reluctant, and there's no question they've put on a pretty good show of that. And I think what you'll see is everybody start moving from exactly what you said, which is no deal, very quickly to deal, because we're not hearing that they have many other alternatives out there.
And indeed, the markets overnight are reacting to all of this drama. The Dow futures are way down. We expect a lower open this morning on Wall Street, and Asian markets aren't terribly happy with what's going on. Overnight, Washington Mutual became the largest bank failure in U.S. history. That has to be on the minds of lawmakers as they get up today and try to tackle this again, right?
Oh, there's no question. And the market is going to send a loud and angry message that that as much as Washington may not be happy about taking ownership of this rescue package, that uncertainty is the thing that Wall Street and markets hate the most. And, really it's a lot of jockeying that's going on. But you don't really hear people offering up anything other than some version of the core rescue proposal that the Bush administration put forward.
So we really don't know the details at this point. I mean, as of yesterday, they were saying there is going to be some sort of issue on compensation, and we were even hearing details late yesterday that this Senator Chuck Schumer idea of something on the order of an installment plan in $250 billion increments, that was actually on the table or part of the agreement. What do you know at this point?
I think actually we do know quite a bit of detail. It's really just a question of everybody being able to hold their hands, hold their nose, and jump. You know, we know that there will be a massive government intervention to buy up distressed assets. The Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson has been pretty clear that there's nobody else out there. The private sector is not going to provide the kind of capital that's needed to get some of these securities that could be very, very valuable off the market essentially for a while. Buy them, hold them, wait for real estate prices to stabilize. So what you're seeing is lawmakers coming together around the idea of, you know, well, $700 billion is really huge, and everybody knows they can't spend that all at once. So if they dole it out, you know, $350 billion at first with the next portion to follow, that wouldn't be too bad. There's pretty wide agreement that there will be limits on executive pay for firms that seek help from the government. The administration had already agreed to a very tight oversight board. They'd already agreed that the government would, as part of this, would have to do more to stop foreclosures for average Americans, which is at the root cause of some of the financial problems going on. So we actually are seeing the components of this coming together. There are some folks like Senator Shelby of Alabama who on principle are never going to be happy with this. They may vote.
Well, and David, I mean, the issue there is Shelby's rhetoric and all of this rhetoric coming out of Washington suggests that this is going to be the tone if there's actually debate on the floor for this resolution to become law. We can only imagine what the negotiations are going to be about trying to limit debate, because everyone's going to want to stand up and publicly hold their nose. David Herzenhorn, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
David Herzenhorn is New York Times reporter on the case in Washington.
And opposition to the bailout plan is also coming from outside the Beltway. This week, over 100 academic economists signed a letter to Congress asking Congress to reconsider, saying the plan is a subsidy to investors at taxpayers' expense. Jeffrey Miron is among those who signed. He is a Harvard University economist, and he comes to us from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why is the bailout a bad idea?
I think it's a bad idea for two reasons. First of all, the basic situation, while serious, is not catastrophic, and if left to work itself out on its own, would lead to moderate costs and disruptions, but not catastrophe. So I don't think that we have a situation that calls for drastic action. Second, the bailout will do a couple of really bad things. First, it will transfer a huge amount of money from the taxpayers generally to people who made risky bets. That is, they issued all these securities, which were highly risky, and it turned out, you know, not to be as valuable as they thought. So the bailout just pays them for having taken this huge bet and lost, but that's insane. That's a crazy kind of economic policy. We don't want to compensate people for taking excessive risk. That encourages the wrong kind of behavior in the economy. So it's two-pronged. One, the problem is not as bad as it's being made out to be, and two, this is a huge transfer in an inappropriate way.
What about the issue of ambiguity? That was highlighted also in that letter.
The ambiguity of what exactly this bailout plan is going to do, that's a really important point. There are so many details that nobody has thought through. There's so much potential for unintended consequences, for the amounts to be adjusted, for the kind of securities that are bought to be different than what's being described, for companies involved to strategically move their assets around, reshuffle things, engage in all sorts of accounting gimmickry so that they get to sell off whatever it is they don't want, completely independent of what makes good sense for the government to buy.
And so then what do you make of President Bush's argument that unless action is taken of this nature, then, I don't know, Armageddon?
I just think that it's an assertion that's not based on past experience or evidence. There's reason to think that first of all, what will happen is some of these companies will go bankrupt. But bankruptcy doesn't mean that a company ceases to exist. It means that it becomes owned by its creditors rather than being owned by its shareholders.
Well, Jeffrey, would you advocate in that regard maybe relaxation of capital rules for banks so that maybe they wouldn't have to put up capital to back these toxic securities and could survive, even though on paper they're looking pretty grim?
Yes, I think that actually makes some sense, and I don't think the capital requirements necessarily made good sense in the first place, so I would be happy to endorse loosening that and let the market decide, okay, what level of capital requirements is appropriate if they're going to be willing to hold the stock of such companies. And if they don't like those low levels of capital, then again, the companies will be forced into bankruptcy, but they will then continue to operate for the most part, but they'll be owned by different people, by their creditors rather than the stockholders, but they will continue to do a lot of what they currently do. So the notion that all mortgage lending will just cease seems to be a huge exaggeration. There will be some disruption, no doubt. There may be some slowdown. There may be a recession. But I think that that's far less than the Armageddon that people are trying to talk about. And it's far less serious than the negative consequences of getting the government involved in owning a huge fraction of one of the most important sectors of the economy.
Jeffrey, what do you make of this piece that was in the Journal yesterday? And, you know, we've heard reports of this all week of finance ministers all around the world saying, oh, look at you, America, you free marketeers, la, la, la. Now you're going to intervene bigger than we ever did before. What do you make of that?
Well, I think in a sense they have a good point. First of all, we haven't been free marketeers in this sector in several very important ways. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were government-sponsored enterprises. They were empowered by government to do something very specific, to try to expand home ownership beyond a level that made good economic sense, and especially in the last 10 years or so, have extended a huge amount of subprime debt. What is that subprime debt? It means loans to borrowers who had terrible credit histories, and that came from government pressure on Fannie and Freddie. That's not free market economics. That is a huge amount of government intervention. So on the one hand, we haven't been practicing free market capitalism,
right,
but certainly they're right to make fun of us because we're getting bad results from
the nananas will continue.
Jeffrey Miron, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeffrey Miron is a Harvard University economist opposed to the bailout plan being discussed, debated heatedly in Washington.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, I want to sort of go over for just a second. I don't know if you saw this, Adora, the details of the Washington Mutual seizure last night. I mean, you talk about drama on Capitol Hill. The board was in the air when the seizure took place. The chairman of the board, Alan Fishman, was actually flying from New York to Seattle by the time the deal was brokered. He landed at the airport and learned that he had no job.
You can't make this stuff up.
No. J.P. Morgan Chase will absorb $31 billion in losses that would normally have gone to the FDIC. That's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So basically, Washington, trying to negotiate this $700 billion deal for a bailout of Wall Street, realized that if WAMU failed, they suddenly were on the hook for $31 billion in losses, which they couldn't afford. So they seized WAMU and forced J.P. Morgan Chase to buy it. Very, very interesting side story that we will have more details on as the morning proceeds. How do you like
I'm
that?
Speechless.
You're in the air and you land and they say, sir, you don't have a job.
The largest bank failure in U.S. history.
Certainly on the minds of American voters. Dante Cheney, who we've been checking in with all campaign long, is director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. He's on the phone from Los Alamos, New Mexico. Dante, thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on.
So each time we speak with you, we've been looking at the Patchwork Nation as a way of slicing and dicing the American electorate, but not using geography, actually using different kinds of categories, and also using these slices as a way of exploring issues. What's the slice you've got for us today?
Well, I thought we're going to talk about two today, which is the service worker centers. These are places that basically a high number of people working service jobs in hotels, restaurants, the hardware store, wherever. And emptying nests. These are places where they have a lot of retirees and people on the verge of retirement, people living on fixed incomes.
People living on fixed incomes who spend their days watching the financial news channels and looking at the economy going up and down and up and down. I gather the economy is probably pretty important to these two groups.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in different sorts of ways. But yeah, these are places, both kinds of places where the economy is a very, very big issue. And as you might imagine, the last couple of weeks, it's really grown.
Well, let's listen to Ray Sanfratello, who's the president of the South Lake County Chamber of Commerce in Clermont, Florida, which is right outside of Orlando. I think it's safe to call him in the community of emptying nests.
I have a younger family, the kids in school, and we've had to cut back on a lot of what I guess you'd call discretionary expenses. Gas prices have climbed here exorbitantly, as they have around the rest of the country, so we don't make the trucks to Orlando like we had done in the past. We're curtailing our shopping. Opportunities to go out to local restaurants are limited.
There you have it in his voice, the ripples that are going through the economy as a result of this downturn and also a financial crisis. You know, we've heard, Dante, that or at least yesterday, Andrea Bernstein was saying that voters that she was talking to and the polls seem to suggest that as this economic story unfolds, it favors John McCain. It favors Barack Obama and at the expense of John McCain very, very significantly. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Doing this project and going around talking to these people, you hope you're getting some kind of representative sample. What we've seen this week, and I've been here in Los Alamos, and I've been down in El Mirage, Arizona, which is the place where it's a big immigrant community, and I've been watching the polls as you guys have, and there has just been a big switch that's gone on, and it seems to me in the last week or so, where a lot of undecideds are starting now. I don't know if it's permanent, but they're all starting to fall Obama's way, at least at the moment.
Would you say the economy is a blue issue at this point, or are there such things as red and blue issues as you see them on the Patchwork Nation quilt?
Well, yeah. Is it blue, red and blue issues? That's a tough thing to call them. But I do think, you know, it's whatever you want to call it. It's something that's favoring Democrats right now, and obviously in large part because the Republicans are in power and Bush is in the White House, and the people don't really think about the Congress. They think about the president as the person who has the power. And, you know, he's taking the blame for this. I had a very interesting experience this week where I talked to somebody in Arizona who knows McCain personally and who has been to football games with McCain and obviously who lives in McCain's home state and was sure he was going to vote for McCain as this thing started. And he's not sure anymore.
Wow. Dante, listen to Kip Ward, who's the owner of the historic Anchor Inn in Lincoln City, Oregon, one of the service workers in the Patchwork Nation.
All the people that I talk to are more frightened than just concerned. At the start of the summer, you know, we drove downtown and there was like two or three vacant store windows. And my wife and I, as we're driving downtown today, we counted 12 or 13. And that's a lot. And this is the tourist season. This is the time that people should be flourishing, not closing their doors. You know, I really suspect that as the winter goes on, that 12 vacant buildings is going to expand.
Dante, it seems as though fear is motivating people, at least in what you're seeing, to make right. up their minds.
Yeah, and, you know, those service worker centers are particularly interesting because these are places where these are a lot of people living on the margins. They're not wealthy. And these aren't people who have a lot of money invested in the stock market. They don't even, a lot of them, have big 401ks or anything like that. But they're the ones who are they get the trickle down effect of the recession, and they're seeing it now.
And they're seeing the abandoned windows in downtown small town America all over the country. Dante Cheney is the director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation project. Thanks, that was pretty fascinating, Dante.
Thank you.
And now headlines from Richard Hake.
And good morning to you both. It's now 28 minutes past the hour, as you've been talking about all morning. J.P. Morgan Chase bought Washington Mutual last night for nearly $2 billion. It marks the largest bank failure in U.S. history. J.P. Morgan Chase also bought Bear Stearns back in March. Lawmakers in Washington still haven't agreed to a plan to bail out banks. The talk stalled after another late night of tense debating. The closed-door sessions will pick up again later on this morning. U.S. and Pakistani troops exchanged fire yesterday when a U.S. helicopter allegedly entered Pakistani airspace. The two countries disagree about whether or not the helicopter actually crossed over the border. It's the second border dispute between the U.S. and Pakistan this week. Chinese astronauts are in orbit 200 miles above Earth. A Chinese spaceship blasted off yesterday morning and will attempt a spacewalk in the next 3 or 4 days.
They're taikonauts.
The Chinese. Is that the word?
Yeah, taikonauts.
Taikonauts.
That's true. It's true. I learned it yesterday. I learned it yesterday.
Well, apparently they're going to try a spacewalk in the next couple days.
Those walking taikonauts.
Well, maybe from up there they can see the tropical storm that has developed.
Good segue.
There we go.
Ooh.
Kyle, this is the 11th named storm of the Atlantic tropical storm hurricane season. It gains strength as it swirls in the open Atlantic just south of Bermuda right now. The National Hurricane Center says Kyle's maximum sustained winds have increased to near 60 miles per hour, and forecasters say the storm could become a hurricane by Saturday as it moves north. So a tropical storm watch has been issued for Bermuda. There's also some rough weather along the Atlantic coast.
Hurricane.
Different system,
right.
But coming up north.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Today in Pakistan, authorities say a bomb blast derailed a train, killing 3 people and injuring at least 15. Now, this attack comes just days after a powerful bomb destroyed the Marriott Hotel in the nation's capital, Islamabad. Meanwhile, Washington is pressing Pakistani officials for answers after the U.S. suspended consular services, citing deepening security worries. And there was an incident along the border between Pakistani forces and U.S. forces. To get more on that, we're joined by BBC correspondent Damian Grammaticus, who is in Islamabad. Welcome, Damian.
Hi.
What do we know about this dispute as it's being described along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border?
Well, we have two pretty clear descriptions of what went on, and neither of them quite tally. Basically, the Pentagon and NATO in Afghanistan say that two of their helicopters were flying in Afghan territory close to the border and were fired on by Pakistani troops. The Pakistanis have said those helicopters clearly crossed over the border into Pakistan and were then fired upon, and there was then also an exchange of ground fire between ground forces on both sides. So in effect, each one of them pointing the blame at the other side, and the only thing they both agree on is that this exchange took place, and that's a pretty poor sign, because remember, these are meant to be the two key allies, if you like, in the fighting the war on terror in this part of the world, and they're shooting at each other, not at the militants.
No, it certainly doesn't bode well for that relationship, and it's also not the first skirmish between the two.
No, it's not. There've been several and skirmishes in which in the past, I think one U.S. soldier has died in the past in skirmishes, and also Pakistani soldiers have. But I think this is coming at a time when there is a very clear raising of tension. The Pakistanis very clearly have been saying they do not want American aircraft, drones, missiles firing on or operating over Pakistani airspace, because they view that as a violation of their sovereignty. From the American side, I think the view we've been hearing is that if actionable intelligence, as it's called, is passed to Pakistan, well, then nothing much happens, and so the patience is wearing out, and American forces are keen to do the job themselves if Pakistan isn't going to.
Because we're really talking about a specific area, a targeted area, which would be the Northwest provinces, where the Taliban, from many reports we've been hearing in the past weeks and months, has essentially reconstituted there.
Yes, exactly. Although it's worth saying this is a pretty huge area. It's a stretch of border that's several hundred kilometers long. I've actually been right to the border where yesterday's incident took place, a place called Ghulam Khan.
Damien, did you take your pet bird with you when you went to the border?
It follows me wherever I go.
Anyway, what did you see at the border?
Well, I was there with American troops last year in Ghulam Khan, what we saw then were police posts that had been, Afghan police posts that had been rocketed Taliban and Pakistani militants who'd come across the border. And it was a real concern. We were shown that area because it was a priority for the Americans to try and strengthen the border defences across there. And that is exactly where this exchange of fire has now taken place. So it's an area where there's tension and an area where there's real concern about infiltration and supply routes coming in from havens in Pakistan supporting the insurgency in Afghanistan.
Just to get back to the consular, to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, how would you describe operations at this point, given the attack of the Marriott Hotel last week?
Well, as I understand it, both the British and American embassies, consular services here, have been suspended. Now, that is a security thing, in as my understanding goes, that what that means basically is that there are offices in the city here that provide visa services. The trouble is that those offices are very popular. A lot of people wanting to travel collect at those offices to apply for visas. There are big crowds outside. There's one usually just a couple of hundred yards actually from where I'm talking to you now, where the British consular services are. And the fear is that that's a prime target now, that it's a Western-linked site. There's crowds of people there, and that it would be a place where militants may well wish to strike. So until security can be reviewed, those have been closed.
And President Zardari here at the UN General Assembly certainly spoke to this issue of the country's sovereign, about his position regarding U.S. troops along the Afghanistan border. He seemed very, very clear.
Yes, I mean, he, from his point of view, he says this is an issue about about Pakistani sovereignty, that violating Pakistani sovereignty simply undermines his own position, his own authority, because he's trying to rally Pakistanis to fight the militants. And what he says happens, and I think he has, there's quite a lot of truth in this, to be honest, is that when American and NATO forces cross over and start targeting the militants, well, Pakistanis who have little sympathy with the militants rally together and see this as an attack on Pakistan, and so their primary sort of dispute then is going to be with the attackers, with the aggressors who they see coming from outside, and it makes it much harder for him to win public support in the campaign against the militants if these people can then paint themselves in some way as defenders of Pakistan against American aggression. So that's why he's asking America not to intervene and not to carry out strikes. But the American side, mm-hmm. you know, the view from America is that if the job isn't being done properly, then somebody does have to target the militants.
Damian Grammaticus, thank you. Damian Grammaticus is a BBC reporter who is in Islamabad. And now we're going to turn to Richard Haake, who's got some headlines for us. Richard?
And Dora, good morning. J.P. Morgan Chase bought Washington Mutual last night for nearly $2 billion. Washington Mutual is the largest bank to fail in U.S. history. Lawmakers in Washington still haven't come up with a plan to bail out banks. The talks stalled after talks late last night. The debate there went awry, and they'll apparently resume this morning. And the stalled talks mean it's not clear if tonight's presidential debate is taking place. Barack Obama says he's heading to Mississippi and wants to proceed. McCain has said he's needed in Washington. In Germany, two terrorist suspects are in custody after being forced off a plane preparing to take off in Cologne. Police found a note saying they wanted to die for jihad. And this is a potential problem for poll takers, the growing number of people who only have cell phones and don't have traditional landline phones. A study finds that if poll takers can't survey the people who only use cell phones, it may slightly alter the results of their polls. This is coming from the Pew Research Center. They find that among people under the age of 30 who only have cell phones, 62% are Democrats and 28% are Republicans.
That affects poll numbers, I would think.
That will definitely skew poll numbers.
Skew poll numbers. That's what people have been saying all campaign long. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You could call it the golden age of television.
Good evening. The television and radio stations of the United States and their affiliated stations are proud to provide facilities for a discussion of issues in the current political campaign by the two major candidates for the presidency.
Sounds so formal, Howard K. Smith, then. Tonight is the first presidential debate between Republican John McCain and Democrat Barack Obama. Hey, they might even show up down there in Oxford, Mississippi. But back then, 1960, on this very day, the candidates were more reliable.
The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
It was the first ever presidential televised debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, kind of a sideshow. People thought of it as something of a novelty. No one believed television would be decisive. But the sideshow quickly became the main event. I'm sure you've heard the story. Richard Nixon famously avoided using makeup, which made him look tired and worn out. Visually, the debate was a decisive win for the confident-looking young, handsome senator from Massachusetts, John Kennedy. But to listen to it, the callow, naive-sounding rich kid seems to be struggling to deal with a question about...
Senator, the vice president in his campaign has said that you are naive and at times immature. He has raised the question of leadership. On this issue, why do you think people should vote for you rather than the vice president?
Sound familiar?
There is no certain road to the presidency. There are no guarantees that if you take one road or another that you will be a successful president.
I can only say that my experience is there for the people to consider. Senator Kennedy's is there for the people to consider. I would say that the people now have the opportunity to evaluate his as against mine, and I think both he and I are going to abide by whatever the people decide.
Wow, back then, you may recall, Nixon was a pre-Watergate cold warrior who jousted with Soviet leaders for all the world to see. There were a few blemishes, of course. The famous Checkers speech didn't come up here. The debate was mostly about domestic issues. It's the economy. I guess they wouldn't have said stupid back then.
I'm not satisfied when the United States had last year the lowest rate of economic growth of any major industrialized society in the world, because economic growth means strength and vitality. It means we're able to sustain our defenses. It means we're able to meet our commitments abroad.
Listen, the youthful voice of JFK and the explainer voice of the sitting vice president.
Let's put it in terms that all of us can understand. We often hear gross national product discussed.
And like today, the economic discussion was a numbers game.
And in that respect, may I say that when we compare the growth in this administration with that of the previous administration, that then there was a total growth of 11% over 7 years. In this administration, there's been a total growth of 19% over 7 years. That shows that there's been more growth in this administration than in its predecessor.
There were many issues addressed in this debate, from the economy to farm subsidies to communism. But as you can hear, it eventually boiled down to a question of legacy. Where had America been since World War II? And who had the vision for the future leading to the 21st century?
Therefore, I think the question before the American people is, are we doing as much as we can do? Are we as strong as we should be? Are we as strong as we must be if we're going to maintain our independence?
It wasn't those presidents that changed the landscape as much as television. From that moment on, television introduced a new way Americans would make their choice at the voting booth, remembering television images that they'd seen during the campaign. You can hear the issues being drawn out, and in the sort of YouTube era that we live in, you can watch and listen to the debate and watch it again. TiVo, your future tonight.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday. It's September 26th, and Richard Hake is in for Femi Oke, and he's got the headlines for us.
And good morning. Just about 12 minutes before the top of the hour, now that WaMu has collapsed and J.P. Morgan Chase has scooped up its remaining assets, J.P. Morgan has become the second largest bank in the United States. WaMu is J.P. Morgan Chase's second acquisition this year of a major bank hobbled by bad mortgage investments. The feds have boosted the amount of dollars it can infuse into foreign markets to $290 billion in a bid by the global central bank to fend off worries over money market funds in the wake of the U.S.'s biggest bank failure in U.S. history. The European Union joins other countries in banning imports of baby food containing Chinese milk. China's tainted baby formula scandal has expanded beyond its borders as three Taiwanese children and a mother are sick with apparently kidney stones from that. Two suicide bombers blew themselves up in a key southern Pakistani city during an intense shootout with officers. Officials say the clash began Friday morning in Karachi when police tried to raid a suspected militant hideout. And back here, Letterman's not laughing. Remember 2 nights ago when John McCain canceled an appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman?
Yeah, he was not happy.
No, well, apparently David Letterman got even more upset when he did go on with Katie Couric on the CBS Evening News.
I feel like an ugly date.
He dropped you.
I feel used.
Yeah.
I feel cheap.
Mm.
I feel sullied. I feel cratered.
I would thought you were going to say
it. There's Late Show host David Letterman offering a second night of jabs at John McCain. Now, a McCain spokeswoman said that the campaign believed Wednesday it wasn't a night for comedy, and they deeply regret offending Mr. Letterman.
It wasn't a night for comedy, but they made comedy out of it, that's for sure.
Two nights of it. Interesting.
Ratings must have went up.
Tonight, presidential hopefuls John McCain and Barack Obama are supposed to kick off the first debate of the general election. But with all the wrangling in Congress over the Bush administration's proposed Wall Street bailout, it may not happen. McCain has vowed not to show up until a deal is done. And it's not clear whether that means there will be a debate tonight or not.
Will Barack feel sullied?
It may not be a word that he would choose.
Probably not.
If the debate doesn't happen, it would be the first time that a scheduled presidential debate did not happen. And we're going to turn now to Alan Schroeder for some historical perspective on presidential debates. He's the author of The Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk Television. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
So what do you make of all this?
Well, you know, it's really hard to know what to make of it because history offers us no roadmap to kind of decode all of this. I think it's a very risky strategy for John McCain to tamper with the debates because I think that his campaign has forgotten one thing, and that is that the American people have a very proprietary feeling about the presidential debates, and they like them. It's after the Super Bowl, the highest rated program of the year, and a lot of people feel that this is a very important moment in the campaign. So I think he tampers with this at his peril.
Given what you know, how likely do you think it is to happen tonight?
I don't have any particular inside information. The one contact inside one of the campaigns that I talked to yesterday said it's as much a mystery to them as it is to the rest of the world. So I don't know. It seems to me that probably what they're trying to do is get him there. My belief is that he'll be there because I think politically it's too risky for him not to. But in order for that to happen, they have to give him some cover story here, some fig leaf that allows him to go in without looking like he's capitulated.
Alan, in the history of presidential debates, and we sort of dipped into the 1960 famous Nixon-Kennedy debate a few minutes ago, has there ever been a consensus on the format? In other words, as we move through time, is it sort of pretty clear the way a debate is conducted in a U.S. presidential campaign?
No, not at all. In fact, we've seen a lot of innovation and change over the years. And this year, the 08 election is the first time that the candidates, for instance, will ever be allowed to directly engage with each other. Up to this point, the campaigns have always been very protective of the candidates, and they've always gone to great lengths to make sure that they don't talk to each other. Well, the format tonight calls for a question to be asked, a response of 2 minutes by each candidate, and then 5 minutes of open discussion. That's something we've never seen in presidential debate. Back in 60, the clips that you were playing there, those were always joint press conferences, basically a panel of reporters asking questions. And we've seen the innovations of the town hall debate. We've seen debates in which the debaters are seated around a table with the moderator as opposed to standing up at a podium. And so there have been some changes. It's very slow. It's very incremental.
But as we've evolved over the last few campaigns, it appears that Jim Lehrer of PBS has become the Ryan Seacrest of presidential debates.
Yes, and I'm sure he'd appreciate that description of himself.
Okay, you've watched all of the debates this year, and there certainly have been many, I think somewhere north of 20. What has struck you about John McCain and Barack Obama's individual styles as debaters?
Well, you know, I think that they're kind of an interesting match because it seems to me that the weaknesses of one are the strengths of the other and vice versa. So that you've got Barack Obama, who's this very introspective guy. I mean, when they ask him the question, you can literally see on his face that he's thinking through his response, which sometimes becomes sort of halting and a little roundabout in terms of getting to the point. Whereas John McCain is this kind of, you know, blunt, direct, almost staccato, action verbs, you know, subject and predicate kind of speaker that presents a real interesting stylistic contrast here.
Well, you know, it's interesting going back to the Kennedy-Nixon debates. I mean, the visual look of Kennedy answering quickly and Nixon, the scholar vice president, thinking. Voters don't like to see their presidential candidates thinking.
Yeah, what does that say about us as a society? That's I don't know. I don't know if that's such a great thing or not.
Alan, you actually started off the conversation when you said that the presidential debates are just behind football, the Super Bowl.
Right.
So what does that say? Interesting. question. But
well, yeah, exactly. That the game is a little more exciting. I mean, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But, you know, that's what's so interesting. I was thinking about this in terms of this McCain strategy is, what if 2 days before the Super Bowl, one of the teams just said, you know what, I'm not so sure I'm going to show up and play after all. You know, imagine the furor, imagine the outcry that would ensue.
And so what should we be looking for if this debate actually does take place?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is, how do they integrate the economy into a discussion that is supposedly devoted to foreign policy and national security? Now, the irony here is that it's the two campaigns themselves that switched the order of debate topics. Originally, this was supposed to be about a debate about the economy, and at the campaign's insistence, the order of those topics from the first and the third debate were swapped. However, I would expect that Jim Lehrer, the moderator, and the candidates themselves, they all want to talk about the economy. So I think if it's under the rubric of national security or the global economy or what have you, I have a feeling that that's where a lot of the conversation will center tonight.
And I guess if you count the debates as, you know, his rating, the fact that Jim Lehrer actually outrates Ryan Seacrest is a sign of a health in American democracy.
You better believe it. And the thing about these debates is they are television shows. There's no question about it. And they're very akin to other kinds of TV shows like reality shows. But there's a huge difference is that they have, you know, a historical consequence. Nixon and Kennedy 48 years ago tonight made that case once and for all.
And, of course, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, those took they were a traveling road show, and those took, like, hours to complete.
Hours,
correct?
3 hours. They would stand up. One would speak for an hour. The other one would rebut for, you know, a lengthy period of time.
But standing room only, right? Standing room only.
Standing room only. Standing room only. It was the best show in town wherever they went.
Alan, very quickly, if you could ask a question tonight, what would it be?
You've really put me on the spot.
Imagine you're Ryan Seacrest.
I stumped you there.
You totally stumped me. You know, I'm so, like, focused on my little narrow research into presidential debates that anytime I meet one of these people, all I want to ask them about is their, you know, debate prep or something insane like that. But if I could get, after this is all over, maybe not so much on the stage, if I could get John McCain aside, I'd sure want to know what was going through his head when he made this decision to potentially boycott the debate in Oxford, Mississippi.
Yeah, Alan Schroeder, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Alan Schroeder is the author of The Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, and he's also a professor of journalism at Northeastern University.
Who, by his own admission, needs to get out more. We're always on it to take away. Election day is less than 6 weeks away. We've got you covered. Go to our website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And here's today's takeaway.
It's really just a question of everybody being able to hold their hands, hold their nose, and jump.
And jump, that's New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn talking about what needs to happen for Congress to pass that $700 billion economic bailout for Wall Street.
Let us know what you think with a call to 877-8-MY-TAKE or an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And join the robust conversation on our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
They burned the night oil trying to save the world economy.
There's got to be a morning after.
Well, not yet. The morning after may be on Saturday for lawmakers. Congress is still bailing. The ship of state is still afloat. Poseidon Adventure, would we call it? Nah, just a cheesy little disaster movie we like to call The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 26th, and cheesy, John?
Disaster movie, yeah. Good morning, Adora.
Today, there are reports from Washington of shouting matches on Capitol Hill, a Treasury secretary down on his knee, and Republican lawmakers bailing on President Bush's proposed rescue plan for Wall Street. We'll have a report. Also, we'll take a look at the trial of Republican Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska, the first sitting congressman to face criminal charges in nearly 30 years. And some religious leaders this weekend plan to challenge the law against campaigning from the pulpit. Those stories coming up, but first we have a few headlines.
It's the biggest bank failure in U.S. history, and it may just have made the biggest bank in history. Federal regulators have taken over Washington Mutual's assets and sold them to now slightly bigger J.P. Morgan Chase for $2 billion. The change means little for customers, but it is bad news. It's the second time in 6 months that J.P. Morgan Chase has taken over a financial institution crippled by bad mortgage debts. There's still no deal on the economic bailout plan, and things are tense on Capitol Hill. Democratic Senator Chris Dodd told CNN that an economic summit at the White House yesterday was just part of the political theater going on right now. The sticking points now seem to be with the GOP. Key Republicans say instead of the government buying up bad debt, they want tax breaks and a new government-backed insurance program like the FDIC. Talks are going to pick up again today.
Tonight's first presidential debate, well, it's on hold. Barack Obama says he plans to show up at the University of Mississippi today, but John McCain would not commit, saying the massive financial bailout plan comes first. The federal corruption trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens is underway. His attorney says Stevens was just clueless about the cost and scope of a pricey makeover of his Alaskan cabin. Prosecutors say he knew better and lied on Senate financial disclosure forms.
In Cologne, Germany, state police say a special commando unit stormed a KLM flight early today and arrested two terrorist suspects. The men left a note saying they wanted to die for jihad. Pakistan's new president, Asif Ali Zardari, told the UN General Assembly that his country can't allow its territory to be violated, even by its friends. This was a reference to an incident on the border where Pakistani soldiers fired at U.S. helicopters.
Oil prices fell a little below 107. In trading today, $107. The Dow gained nearly 2% yesterday to close at 11,022, and the S&P was up nearly 2%. It's set to open at 1209.
And set to open down, markets are reacting very, very negatively, at least in the futures, to what's going on Capitol Hill. $700 billion turns out to be about $2,300 a head in the United States. But what does it really mean to you? That's an abstraction. The financial collapse, and say the collapse of Washington Mutual, a bank that probably has ATMs in your neighborhood, how is this going to affect you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It was another late, late night in Washington, D.C., with reports of shouting matches, Republicans launching an 11th-hour revolt, and a president watching his proposal to shore up the economy with a $700 billion Wall Street bailout fall apart. For the latest, we go to our friend in Washington, Todd Zwillick of the Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
Senator Christopher Dodd calls it political theater.
Yeah, well, it smacks of that. It really does. All those things you described all happened. They came out of a meeting last night around 10:30. Dodd was visibly shaken and frustrated. He was kind of red in the face and using words like he detests doing this at this point. I don't think they ever expected to get here. And they're going back into meetings today. And the interesting thing was you had this House Republican plan sort of come out midday yesterday. It's only a three-paragraph plan. It takes up about four-fifths of one piece of paper. But the meeting last night, when we asked them if they were taking it into account, the negotiators in the room, including the Republicans in the room, said that they weren't really working on it.
I have this image of like a pizza guy coming to the White House saying, you know, bringing the pizza for the guys. And it's like they've stumbled in on a domestic dispute. Everyone's screaming and yelling and red faced.
What's that issue? What is the problem? Because there were all kinds of reports yesterday that the sides had come to an agreement with the administration. Where are the obstacles now?
Well, when the sides said they had come to an agreement with the administration, the House Republicans would tell you that the sides spoke too soon because they weren't cut in on the deal. Now, that seemed a little bit strange to a lot of people because the House Republicans had somebody in the room. They had a guy called Spencer Backus, who's the senior Republican on the House Financial Services Committee. So we all said to the Republicans, you had somebody in the room, and they said he wasn't authorized to negotiate. And then the logical question is, well, why didn't you send someone who is authorized to negotiate? And the answer was, we have not negotiated with anyone. So I think only House Republicans know why they weren't in on the deal. What we do know is that they don't like the deal that's being crafted by everyone else. That's House and Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans in the White House, the Treasury. So you mentioned all the things, capital gains, tax cuts, and insurance program. That seems to be the stumbling block now. And there's a political stumbling block. That's the real stumbling block.
Wow.
Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats need a critical mass of Republicans because nobody wants to own this. They can pass this without the Republicans in the House. They can pass it. Democrats can pass it. But they don't want to own this plan. They want it to be bipartisan because that calms the markets. And as Barney Frank said last night, if you pass something that's not bipartisan, the markets are going to think it's just going to change next year. That's not going to instill confidence. And politically, nobody wants to own this thing. Nobody knows if it's going to work or not. So if one party passes it and then everything falls apart, imagine the 30 second ads you're going to see on that one.
How close were the campaigns to these negotiations, Todd? Any idea?
Well, the campaigns are critically important. Of course, John McCain and Barack Obama were in town. The people, the Democrats especially, say up until the White House meeting yesterday, John McCain had absolutely nothing to do with any of this. He's not on any of the relevant committees. Of course, he's been out campaigning. He wouldn't have anything to do with it. He's out campaigning. Now that he's in the picture, you know, remember that phrase that gets thrown around, too big to fail, that was about, Lehman Brothers and all that?
Sure.
This thing has become too big to fail. It really has. And so now the question is, how do they go forward? And also the question is, now that John McCain is involved, and now that John McCain has said he will not debate and he will not leave town until something is solved, then you have to assume that he's not going to leave town until he has his fingerprints on some kind of rescue of the rescue. Now, only they know how that's going to play out, but it makes you wonder how exactly this is going to get solved when now, in order to get the fifth cog in the five-spoke wheel, get the House Republicans of the fifth cog, you know, they have to give John McCain a victory, and Democrats certainly aren't going to be interested in doing that, and the Treasury just wants something to get done. So it's a little complex right now.
So what's the plan for today?
Meetings at 11:30 with all of the frustrated principals that met last night from the House and Senate. They've winnowed that group down. They don't have 18 or 20 people in the room anymore. Harry Reid came in last night and kicked out anyone who is extraneous. There were five people in the room. One person from House and Senate, Republican, Democrat, and Paulson. That's it. Nobody else in the room. Everybody else got kicked out. So they're going to probably do that again today at 11:30. The staff is meeting as well. And that's all we know.
Todd Zwillick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, keeping us informed on what's happening on Capitol Hill. He's from the Capitol News Connection. John?
And joining us now is Peter Goodman from the New York Times to talk about the details of this bailout and what seems to be a very related story, the seizure by the federal government of Washington Mutual, the largest bank failure in the United States, and the forcing, at least that's according to reports, of J.P. Morgan Chase to buy its assets for something on the order of $2 billion. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it's my understanding that the failure of Washington Mutual, if it had been allowed to completely fail, would have triggered something on the order of $31 billion from the federal government being tapped for federal deposit insurance accounts. To prevent that, the government sees this. Are we really sort of in a margin of $31 billion makes or breaks the entire banking system at this point?
Well, I mean, the FDIC is so depleted, and there are so many worries about how many people are going to show up asking for the money in its coffers, that at this point, the federal government has to think, what do we need to do here to prevent a bank run?
So what does need to be done? I mean, buying Washington Mutual is just one small step. There's a lot of other bank deposits that are at risk here, and certainly the markets are not looking very positively at this sort of show that was going on in Washington last evening.
Well, the word we hear over and over again is confidence, this need to restore confidence in the financial system, because the minute the vultures start circling, you know, one potential carcass, you get into the self-fulfilling prophecy part of the conversation. I mean, anytime you see the vultures, then anybody who's got deposits there, sorry to mix the metaphor, you know, they show up and say, well, give me my money back before this thing dies. And so the game here for the federal government is to make sure that you strengthen whoever might fall before they get to the point where it's too late. And so in this case, I mean, it seems they said, well, we can't have, you know, this one bank go down, because if they go down, that takes confidence down to a whole, you know, new depth. And somebody starts showing up at some other bank trying to pull their money out, and before you know it, the FDIC just doesn't have enough money on hand to bail out whoever's in trouble. So better to get this this one bank in the hands of somebody else, you know, make them part of J.P. Morgan Chase's empire, and hope that's enough to restore confidence so we don't have to act somewhere else.
An empire that maybe by the end of today will be bigger than Citigroup for the first time. It'll be the largest bank in U.S. history. But let's talk about the bailout itself. An economist we spoke to earlier said there would not be anything wrong with just forcing these banks and allowing them to take write-downs on all of these bad loans and bad assets and basically posting them, having, you know, a couple of bad years, and then going on with life. What would be so wrong with having depositors express confidence in the federal government bailing them out if, for instance, they can't get their money out of the bank through the normal procedures like the FDIC, rather than giving this money directly to the banks straight out of the Treasury?
Well, let's remember, the FDIC covers deposits. So banks that take deposits in the traditional way have some form of insurance, I mean, to the degree to which we believe the FDIC's got enough money. And obviously, I mean, the federal government's there to bail out FDIC if it, God forbid, it comes to that. But there's a whole shadow financial system, which is the system that really matters here. That's the system that's been borrowing incredible amounts of money, lending staggering quantities of money, cooking up this huge pile of money through derivatives. I mean, we've heard about credit default swaps, essentially these very sophisticated, hard-to-price bets. Some people describe as, you know, a big casino in the sky.
Well, and that casino shutting down means that there's less loans. And we were talking with people earlier in the week who aren't getting business loans to finance activity, and they've already had to take impacts to their bottom line. We're going to get GDP numbers this morning. Any chance we're going to see in those gross domestic product numbers a sign that this is beginning to have an effect?
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, it may be too early. The biggest concerns at this point focus on the last 3 months of the year, because remember, in the middle of the year, the economy was still lubricated by these checks the government sent out to stimulate the economy. There's a lot of uncertainty about what today's numbers will bring.
And so stay tuned, and a stimulus package that would save us from this crisis is probably a little hard to fathom at this point. Peter Goodman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Goodman, reporter for The New York Times, focusing on the economic impacts of the bailout not being signed and what we have to look forward to over the next 3 months. Adora? Not fun.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. There's actually supposed to be a debate tonight, but if the candidates don't show up, you still can go to thetakeaway.org. We're going to be live Twittering at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, along with the political director, Andrea Bernstein, and you. You can join the conversation on our takeaway.org website, also on Twitter. We're going to be talking about what you need to hear in the debate, what the candidates need to say to change your mind and be decisive, like Joanna wants.
My question at the debate tonight would be, why did McCain spend so little time, or how did he go about choosing Sarah Palin to be the person who would become president if something happened to him?
Maybe it will come up. Probably not if he doesn't show up. But 877-8-MY-TAKE, your question for the debate, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Among the places that are going to be tuned into the debate tonight are the people in the counties that count we've been focusing on over the course of the campaign. Prince William County in Northern Virginia this week, which was the place where Andrea Bernstein, our political director, was visiting to try to take the pulse of places that seem to be in transition, moving from pro-Republican to pro-Democrat, at least in their sort of surface tension. First of all, thinking about the debate tonight and thinking about what is likely to be decisive for people in counties, in battleground states that are critical and in transition, what do you think people are going to be listening to?
Well, one of the things in Prince William County is that immigration was a huge local issue there. And we haven't heard a lot about immigration so far in the general election. A lot of people are looking to hear from it tonight. In Prince William County, there was a dispute over day laborers, as there frequently is. There was an effort to get them a center to wait instead of loitering in front of the 7-Elevens. The people and the town officials who tried to do that were thrown out. And subsequently, a law was passed that everybody in Prince William County who was stopped for any offense for any reason would have their citizenship papers taken, checked, and then most of the immigrants left literally overnight, it was explained to me, including some of them abandoning very nice houses. But this is an issue that is really top of the mind. It's raw. Yesterday morning, I was in the Yorkshire restaurant in Manassas, a little bit lower down on the economic scale, but people still working people, going around talking to people, eating their French toast and Western omelets. This couple, Scott McCarter and his breakfast companion, were talking about their feelings about John McCain, which are a little bit counterintuitive.
I like the borders to be really taken care of quicker and better than this game plan that's just hasn't been followed through with. Got a comment, Scott?
They tried amnesty, another amnesty.
You didn't like what he was doing?
No. Most of the Americans did not either. So they made their voices heard.
Do you hold that against Senator McCain?
Oh, yes, certainly.
You think that it might affect your vote?
It would have, except from voting for Palin. I'm not voting for McCain.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard that. Very, very interesting. And the decisive issue is immigration for him.
It is immigration. And,
it is hard to catch that logic because ultimately a vote for Palin is a vote for John McCain.
Correct. But this is sort of the Republican Party part of the Republican Party that didn't like John McCain. Remember, they called him Juan McCain in the primaries because they thought he was too pro-immigrant. There is this sort of grasping for detail. So you would think in a county like Prince William County, traditionally Republican, voted for Bush in 2000, that the immigration issue would be ginning up the Republican vote. But guess what? There are a lot of Latinos who live there who are voters who are also very now inspired to go to the polls. One of them was Leo Vega. He ran a bodega right next to the Yorkshire restaurant. And I asked him what happened to his business when everybody left.
How about your own business? Has it been affected?
Oh, my God. Compared to last year, we've gone down 75%. And I was looking at the news. These multimillionaire companies, they're asking for help. Imagine us, you know. I don't want $700 billion, you know. I would love to have at least, you know, some type of money to keep my business afloat. And this is mine and my wife's. We started this.
Well, you can really feel the pain there. These are passionate supporters of Barack Obama, or is it more lukewarm, like those McCain supporters?
No, they're without a doubt. I mean, there were people quite a few people with accents across the income scale who were naturalized citizens. Some people were business owners. Some people came and worked with the mall.
they were all for Obama, and they all told me with great certainty that they were going out to vote. So, of course, these people have made up their minds. The people in the middle, like a woman, Tina, who worked as an events planner, who I spoke to, she said she's a Republican. She's voted Republican all her life, but she is struggling. And she said she was really considering thinking about voting for Obama. When I talked to her about immigration, she had a very complex view. On the one hand, she said it's not up to us Americans to solve everybody's problems. But on the other hand,
I just had some work done on my house. The Americans that I had come in and do the job didn't do a good job. The second company that came in, one laid tile, one group laid tile, one group laid carpet. Neither one of them spoke barely any English, but they did an excellent job.
So the levels are complex, and one of the reasons that people do want a debate is because people all over Prince William County were yearning for policy details. When I said, what do you want to hear at the debate, if it happens, people said, I want to know more what I want to do. I don't want to just hear these negative ads. Here's Tina.
There are some things that I need to hear from him that I'm not hearing yet. I'm still seeing ads that just tell me I watched both the Republican convention and the Democratic convention. I was unimpressed by McCain's speech. He looked phony. He sounded phony. He sounded like he didn't know. I just was not impressed.
Boy, not a lot of enthusiasm there. You can hear the county in transition and all over this immigration issue. I should say, you mentioned that this was over loitering of immigrants. They would say, in fact, they were being picked up for day labor at the 7-Eleven, right, at the beginning.
Right.
That's what they were. I just wanted to make
that clear. And these undecideds, they want the debate tonight. Even if they think McCain should be working on the bailout, they want to hear more from him, more details.
We'll be watching. They'll be watching. Andrea Bernstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
More on the counties that count later on in the campaign. But now headlines from Richard Hake.
And John, coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, JPMorgan Chase has a new bank in its collection. It bought Washington Mutual last night for $1.9 billion. Negotiations nosedived yesterday in Washington over the White House's proposed financial bailout plan. Lawmakers seemed to come to an agreement yesterday afternoon, but then locked horns after an economic summit at the White House. Discussions apparently will pick up later on this morning. Pakistan's president is telling U.S. troops along the broad Afghan border to stay out. Yesterday, troops from both sides exchanged fire after a U.S. helicopter allegedly crossed the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Also, Russia and Venezuelan officials agreed to bolster cooperation in the oil and gas industry, the latest sign of strengthening ties between the two nations trying to decrease U.S. influence around the world.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer cash rewards to students for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it like merit bonuses in business? Viewpoints at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. The supposed magic of the marketplace is looking a little more like a horror show this morning. We're talking about the elusive $700 billion bailout plan in Washington and the collapse of Washington Mutual, largest bank failure in U.S. history. Also, markets poised to open much lower this morning. And what do you think about that?
Good morning. My name is Sam. My response to takeover of all these Wall Street places would be, welcome to new Republic Socialist of United States of America.
What's your takeover take? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
While a bailout debate in Washington is on the minds of many, it's not the only story in Washington, D.C. This week, the trial of Alaskan Republican Senator Ted Stevens began. He is the first sitting member of Congress to face criminal charges in nearly 30 years. We are joined now by Alaskan Public Radio reporter Libby Casey, who is covering the trial. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning.
So the prosecutors paint the senator as a very savvy man who was fundamentally aware of the fact he was taking goodies from Vico and not reporting it.
That's right, and we've heard over the last few weeks how the prosecution might go about proving this. They're going to try to show that in about a six-year period, the senator, for some reason in his 70s, decided that he was above the law and that he could take favors, he could take things like the reconstruction of his Alaskan home, and no one would really be the wiser. And they said that, you know, whereas most Americans, they told the jurors, you know, you and I reach for the phone book when we need something done, the yellow pages, well, Ted Stevens reached for Vico. They were like his personal handyman.
And what's his defense? What are his lawyers saying?
This was the first chance we had yesterday during opening statements to hear Ted Stevens' defense. When this all started to unfold about a year ago, he pounded his fist at what one meeting with the press and said, you know, we paid every bill that we got regarding the construction of this home he has in Alaska. But since then, he's been mum, and we didn't really know what his lawyers would say. And what they're saying is that there is absolutely no reason why this guy, it's, you know, such a venerable career, he's been a senator for 40 years, would suddenly sort of go rogue, go bad. And that actually what's happened is very innocent. People give him gifts, and the gifts were really incidentals, and things either were actually reported on his Senate financial disclosure forms, or he gave the gifts back, so or they were gifts he never knew about.
So it's the Ted Stevens defense. Hey, I'm Ted Stevens. You can't possibly think I'm bad.
Or,
well, you know, they all... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and in addition, my wife, it's my wife's fault.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're going to see how this plays out. But what Stevens' lawyer said is that his wife, Catherine, was actually the one in charge of the finances of this home that they were having renovated in Alaska. She was the one who paid all the bills. She was the one who dealt with that. And they also blamed this guy named Bill Allen. Now, Bill Allen was the CEO of Vico. And Vico's a name we're going to be hearing a little bit about in the next couple of weeks. It was once one of the largest employers in Alaska. And its CEO, Bill Allen, has now really, I mean, it's just a story gone bad. He's admitted to bribery of many state legislators in Alaska. Well, he was a good friend of the Stevens family, and he was overseeing the construction. And the defense team says it was him that was messing around with the bills.
And we're talking about $250,000 worth of gifts?
Yes, and it largely revolves around the renovation of this house. And, you know, it's this great thing about being in a courtroom, the courtroom drama. The prosecution calls it a chalet, and they say it's in a ski town in Alaska. And the defense calls it a modest home that was really like a cabin before it was renovated. And it's in a town on dirt roads with a very small population.
And how is this going over in Alaska, where Ted Stevens is facing re-election?
I think we're going to find out this weekend. You know, the news is sort of hitting the stands this morning and last night about opening statements and what his defense is going to be. But this has really big implications because he is facing a very tough re-election in November. It's so soon. And they're hoping to get the trial done before that. But, you know, Alaskans are so far away from Washington, D.C., and so their only connection to this is reporters. There are a lot of Alaskan reporters down here sending back a lot of stories. You know, Ted Stevens is so respected back home. We actually call him Uncle Ted. But Alaskans are sick of the corruption. They're sick of the scandals that have really plagued the state over the last few years.
And it's also touched this trial, this case, this company, Vico, has also touched the presidential election. Vice presidential nominee, Republican vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, did she receive some kind of contributions during her governor race?
Well, Vico, as I mentioned, was a huge employer in Alaska and gave generously to many politicians. Then this scandal broke, and there have been trials in Alaska where these Vico executives were actually caught on tape giving money over to state legislators. So many politicians, including Palin, gave any Vico money they had back. And, you know, something interesting that happened yesterday with the governor, she had an opportunity to sort of defend Stevens and endorse his run. They're both Republicans, you know, big Alaskan Republican stalwarts, and she declined to. She told reporters, we're going to have to wait to see how the trial plays out.
Libby Casey, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Libby Casey is a reporter for Alaska Public Radio, and she was coming to us from Washington, D.C. And now we're going to Head over to Richard Haake, who's got some headlines for us. Richard?
And it's about 21 minutes before the hour. Adora, Washington Mutual customers fear not. That's according to the FDIC, which insured Washington Mutual. They say last night's acquisition by J.P. Morgan Chase will not disturb transactions. The White House and lawmakers walked away from negotiations on the financial bailout last night without a plan. The lawmakers will give it another go this morning. And the lack of agreement means it's still not clear if tonight's presidential debate is happening. Barack Obama says he's headed to Mississippi as scheduled. And the Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, just told me as we passed in the hall that his official schedule was just released and his trip to Mississippi is on that. John McCain says he's needed in Washington and as of now wants to postpone. And he hasn't released an official schedule in a couple of days. Off the coast of Somalia, pirates have taken a Ukrainian ship carrying at least 30 military tanks. The equipment could be very dangerous in Somalia, already awash with weapons. The U.S. military says a roadside bomb has killed an American soldier in the south of Baghdad. A statement says the blast that killed the soldier struck a vehicle that was part of a combat patrol. The military says the incident is under investigation. At least 4,173 members of the U.S. military have died in the Iraq War since it began in March of 2003. And the storm brewing in the tropics right now is Tropical Storm Kyle. It has gained strength as it swirls in the open Atlantic now, just south of Bermuda.
A hurricane, that's what we need. Nothing really is going on much.
You want another hurricane?
Yeah,
you think it's time?
That's what we need now is a hurricane.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, the National Hurricane Center says Kyle's maximum sustained winds have increased to near 60 miles per hour. Not quite a hurricane yet. Forecasters do say that the storm could become a hurricane by Saturday as it moves north. So a tropical storm watch has been issued for Bermuda. Not clear yet if it will hit the coastline of the United States.
Could we steer it to just go into Washington? That might help things.
You could be a hurricane, John. Get up in the plane and encourage it where to go.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. You recognize that song?
Oh, yeah. Rhapsody in Blue.
Rhapsody in Blue. George Gershwin. If he were alive today, he'd be 110 years old, the iconic composer whose short life changed American music and has inspired people for nearly a century. Here's Woody Allen in the opening scene from the movie Manhattan.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now, let me start this over. Chapter 1.
That song, Rhapsody in Blue, even ended up as a signature for United Airlines.
Come fly the friendly skies.
United licensed Rhapsody in Blue in 1976 from Gershwin's estate for $500,000. The song actually premiered in a concert called An Experiment in Modern Music on February 12, 1924 in New York with Gershwin playing the piano. It marked an enormous turn for the young composer, making him a star and catapulting jazz from beloved local clubs to concert halls. Shortly before his death, Gershwin wrote the aria Summertime for the 1935 opera Porgy and Bess. The song soon became and remains a hugely popular jazz standard, said to be the most covered song with over 17,500 different versions recorded, from Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. To an entirely different version by Janis Joplin in 1969. Here she is in Stockholm.
Summertime. Shine.
to the punk reggae band Sublime. Gershwin was born on this date in Brooklyn in 1898 and died young of a brain tumor. We leave with the words of Broadway entertainer Harry Hirschfeld from Gershwin's memorial service in 1937.
In George Gershwin's own music, we have all the eulogy necessary to honor the deceased. Gershwin's rights must be respected. He wrote for men and women, regardless of race, color, or creed, to dance, to sing, and to not be afraid to live. So strike up the band.
George Gershwin died at 38.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. If there is a debate tonight, what do you want to hear the candidates discuss and what would be decisive in your mind? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. You get to ask the debaters a question on our website. My take at thetakeaway.org. This Sunday, some pastors across the United States are going to step into the pulpit and intentionally break the law. That's the idea, anyway. They'll be preaching sermons that tell parishioners explicitly who to vote for. This is a challenge, in theory at least, to federal tax law. Churches, like other nonprofit organizations, have tax exemptions that come with this hitch. They cannot have any direct involvement in political campaigns. Now, it could be a temptation for many religious leaders during this historical election year to actually make this challenge, but we've invited two pastors onto the program to talk about what's at risk here. Pastor Gus Booth, War Road Community Church in War Road, Minnesota. Pastor, your intention is to challenge that law this Sunday, correct?
That is correct.
And also joining us is the Reverend Eric Williams, Senior Pastor of North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus, Ohio. Reverend Williams, what are you going to do on Sunday?
Well, I'm going to listen with interest. Last Sunday, I spoke in favor of separation of church and state.
So you will not be explicitly endorsing a candidate on Sunday?
I have never endorsed and never will endorse a candidate as a minister.
Pastor Booth, what is the idea in the challenge that you're going to make, and can you tell us who you'll be endorsing?
Yeah, the idea and the challenge is simply that the IRS has made a law that is in competition with freedom of speech, and I guess I just don't feel like my freedom of speech is infringed upon when I step behind the pulpit, or shouldn't be. And so that's the genesis or the crux of the situation, and I'm going to endorse John McCain.
Do you feel as though you're crossing the Rubicon in some sense? Any nerves about getting up there? I know pastors aren't typically known for being nervous before sermons.
No, not really, I guess. There'll be some media there, which is be a little unusual for us, but you know, the bottom line is the gospel needs to be preached into all areas of life, and politics is one of those areas.
Reverend Williams, what's wrong with endorsing a candidate? Certainly, God is something that is very much discussed in the political campaign. We heard a lot about it all this year.
Well, I think it's marvelous that we include God in our discussion about politics, but it's not a matter of free speech. It's a matter of using tax dollars to endorse a candidate. Reverend Booth certainly has the freedom to talk about a candidate outside of his role as a minister, and that doesn't violate the law. But when you use tax dollars to endorse a candidate, tax-free dollars, that is breaking the law. And more than that, I'm sure Reverend Booth can talk about any of the issues that the voters are concerned about and still not endorse a candidate. So he, in fact, is free to raise up all the major issues, inspire, equip, encourage his members, apart from telling them who to vote for.
So, Pastor Booth, pay your taxes, and you can endorse whoever you want.
Well, churches are by nature not taxable. We don't have to have a 501c3 in order to not be taxable. We have never been taxed in the history of our nation. And so, and also the IRS does take issue with code words, what they say. So I can't use words like Democrat or Republican or pro-choice or, you know, pro-life or liberal or conservative because, you know, the underlying principle is that, well, the IRS is smart enough to know that we will use code words without endorsements, so they've taken issue with that as well.
Well, how smart is the IRS and the judiciary on this matter? It seems like a very interesting confluence and conflict of doctrines in the United States. And joining hold on one second, Pastor.
Sure.
Joining us to help sort this out, because I need a refresher course, is Marcy Hamilton, professor of law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University here in New York. Marcy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, happy to be here.
Can you describe the conflict between, as Pastor Booth is saying, the tax law that sets explicit conditions of behavior and speech for a tax exemption and the First Amendment right to free speech?
Well, the argument is being made that there should be no limitation on anything a pastor says because there is some notion of either an absolute or an unlimited right to free speech, but of course there is no unlimited right to free speech, and it is constitutional to set limits on tax-exempt status. What's at stake for these churches is not whether they speak or not, it's only whether or not they're going to benefit from having tax-exempt status from their income. This has nothing to do with property tax exemptions, which are state and local laws. This is all about federal income tax. And if they want the federal income tax benefit, they cannot act like a PAC. And that's really what's going on. Are they going to be a political action committee or a nonprofit?
Well, what is the chance, Marcy, and some have said the intent of this challenge is to actually make a Supreme Court case out of this where the issue would be showcased in a very, very celebrated Supreme Court case if it makes it all the way there? What's the likelihood of that, do you think?
Oh, I think this is actually being orchestrated. It's pretty clear by the Alliance Defense Fund, which is a far-right conservative. It's the ACLU for the far right, and they are looking for the best case, which is one of the reasons I'm sure they've asked as many pastors as possible to do this. They'll look for the best set of facts and use that to go up on these First Amendment arguments.
Except, Professor Hamilton, what I asked was not so much how it's orchestrated, and, you know, lawsuits are orchestrated by lots of institutions on all kinds of issues throughout history. The question really is, what's the likelihood, based on past Supreme Court decisions, of this making it to a challenge at the highest level?
Well, I think the fact there will be enough challenges because of the size of the civil disobedience on Sunday, that once you have that many cases, the Supreme Court can no longer not weigh in. So if you have enough cases, and certainly if you have courts ruling in different ways, and the court needs to weigh in as sort of a referee, we will see it at the Supreme Court. So I don't think there's much chance that the court will be able to avoid it. The question is twofold. One, will it get to the court? But two, there's also very active lobbying in Congress to get this rule repealed.
Okay, Marcy, let me ask Pastor Booth if that is his intent. Is your mission to convert your parishioners or guide them to a particular vote, or is it to get to the Supreme Court?
Both.
I see. And is that a fundamental change in your view of your role as a pastor?
Yeah, it is. Matter of fact, when I first became a pastor, I realized I didn't want to take political sides because I didn't want to needlessly offend the other side and then not have the ability to share the gospel with them. But then I read the platform to the Democratic, you know, their platform, and I realized it was like a how-to manual on how to sin. It was so antithetical to Scripture that I just realized I need to take leadership on this issue, and we need to take the gospel into all areas of life. And to answer the question about the tax exemption, if you are exempt, then you are somehow have to give up your freedom of speech. Political action committees are tax-exempt organizations, for goodness sake. So if they can speak about politics, why can't churches speak about politics?
Reverend Williams, what do you say to that?
Well, the tax structure is different from that, I understand. What I'm really concerned about is jeopardizing a couple of things the way Reverend Booth talks. One is it jeopardizes the freedom of conscience. I think that the voting booth is really sacred. When each person goes into that booth, each person votes his or her conscience. And if the minister has told that person how to vote, that minister has that kind of power, that kind of influence. I don't know that person is voting his or her own conscience. And the other concern I have is while it's fine for Reverend Booth to talk about the values and the concerns of the day from his particular religious point of view, the neighbor down the street may look at life differently. But and there needs to be respect for our neighbor in this as well.
But, Pastor Williams, isn't it true that parishioners can kind of figure this out, that there is a bit of a word game going on here, that everybody knows what everyone is saying there in the pulpit?
I think everybody, when a pastor is a good pastor to its member, his or her members, certainly they're going to know what the pastor thinks and feels. So find a venue to do that, and not step into the pulpit and abuse that pulpit by telling the people. I mean, I've actually asked people who say, if my minister says so, then that's what I should do.
Pastor Booth, is that the way your parishioners operate? If you endorse, they'll vote for John McCain?
No, I think they'll vote for John McCain because they are biblically astute people, and most biblically astute people needs to vote for the most biblical candidate.
All right, Pastor Booth, then actually we're gonna go now, but good luck on Sunday, and I'd love to be there at coffee hour to see what the reaction is. Pastor Gus Booth of the War Road Community Church in War Road, Minnesota, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, brother.
And Reverend Eric Williams, Senior Pastor of North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Marcy Hamilton, it'll be interesting to watch. Thank you for joining us.
Very entertaining.
Professor of Law at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law at Yeshiva University.
We're always on at the Takeaway, and Election Day is less than 6 weeks away. We've got you covered. You'll find our complete coverage on our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
It's only a three-paragraph plan. It takes up about four-fifths of one piece of paper.
That's our man on the Hill, Capital News Connection. Todd Zwillick was the second running takeaway of this week. He's got a streak going. The plan to save the economy is no bigger than an 8x10 piece of paper.
8x10. Let us know what you're thinking about what's happening on Capitol Hill. 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.